Okay. Hi. Hi, everyone.
Hi. Hello.
If you're tuning in, get ready because we are still on our hiatus and we are coming back the first week of January, but we want you to stay subscribed. So we're recasting some of our favorite episodes of season 11. Tessa, do you have anything you want to share with everybody?
I'm sorry. What do I want to share? Well, folks, it's been like a November to remember. And I hope you all are doing well. And yeah, like Rosie said, stay tuned because we've got some really good shit coming out in January.
Oh, she said it. And it's true. And if you're a little curious, look, Tessa and I have both been going through a lot of changes, physically, emotionally, spiritually, everything in between. And we're so excited to bring you this new and revamped content the first week of January. So stay tuned, enjoy this episode, and we'll see you back really soon.
Hello, friends. I'm Rosie Acosta, your host and guide on this journey to self-discovery and radical love. I've walked a path filled with challenges. Growing up in East LA during the 92 LA riots, it left me searching for meaning, for mentors, for a way to truly understand the purpose of life. But you know what I found? The power of conversation. As a first-gen Mexican-American, these conversations became my compass, offering insight, support, and an endless amount of inspiration. So I decided to create a space where we can share these conversations with you, our community. And that's how the Radically Loved podcast was born. Join me as we dive into topics like mindfulness, spirituality, self-love, and the keys to overall healthy living. I'm joined by my dear friend, fellow author, producer, and teacher, Tessa Tovar.
Hi, I'm Tessa, and I'm grateful to be part of this community because it teaches me so much about what it means to be human. Ever since I was a little one, I was always asking my dad the deeper questions in life. Why are we here? What happens when we are gone? What is the purpose of life? I love this show because I get to ask the questions that cut right to the meaning of life. I've learned that no matter how much we want the path to be clear or straightforward, it rarely is. And that is actually part of the beauty that creates a radically loved life.
Please do us a favor, share the episodes you love with your friends, and leave us a review. Together, we'll learn how to create a life that's truly, deeply, radically loved. Let's begin.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Radically Loved podcast. This is Tessa here today. I'm your host. And we are having a very special guest on the show today, Nicole Vignola, who is a neuroscientist. And she's got a new book out. It's called Rewire Your Neuro Toolkit for Everyday Life. Nicole's background in neuroscience and organizational consulting, and she specializes in making neuroscience tangible for the masses. She has an established platform that teaches millions, providing them with practical tools and science-backed methods to improve mental health, optimize reflexes, and reach peak mental performance to enhance their daily lives. Nicole has a BSc in neuroscience from the University of Bristol and an MSc in organizational psychology from the University of the West of England. And we're going to dive into all kinds of really cool topics today, such as why our brain has a negativity bias, the neuroscience of a breakup, what's going on in the brain, why do we feel like addicted to our ex after a breakup, subconscious brain, how it operates, the power of visualization, and so much more. I'm so excited to dive into this conversation. And without further ado, here we go.
All right, Nicole. So I want to dive right into the meat of this subject and your good work. And thank you so much, by the way, for writing this book. I find that a toolkit is so helpful. And we're talking about neuroscience, which is a topic that I just find endlessly fascinating. Obviously, you do too. Otherwise, you wouldn't be studying it, teaching it, and writing about it. So the first thing I want to touch on is I feel like such a ingrained and maybe for a lot of us, subconscious thing that we experience. And that is this negative bias that our brain has. It tends towards like catastrophizing the worst case scenario. Why is that?
Yes, it's one of probably the biggest questions I get, and one that resonates with everyone I speak to. And I love it because when you empower people with the information and the knowledge, you can already start changing these patterns of behavior. So we do have a negativity bias as humans. We tend to dwell on the negative, likely due to evolutionary reasons, survival needs. How many centuries and how many generations do we need to go through before that hardwiring gets changed? I'm not entirely sure. But, out of the 8 basic emotions, we have 2 positive ones. And then surprise is positive or negative, depending on the context or the situation. So we are hardwired to care more about the negative emotions, because that's what makes sure that we stay alive and stay healthy as well. So knowing that means that if A validates us, and you can kind of say, it's not you, it's your brain, but mm-hmm. you can also change that, which is the great thing. So, and the first step is to even acknowledge that and then even change those automatic patterns. So, jumping to conclusions or seeing a friend's post and automatically thinking, something negative about them or saying something negative. I'm around people that tend to be like, yeah, no, she's great, but, and I'm like, no, she's great. She's great, full stop. And I think it's such a common thing that we've also habituated as well through, our society, et cetera. So, but I think it helps people understand that, why it happens and then bring attention to what needs to change.
Yeah. Well, and you're already touching on the next subject I wanted to bring up, which is habits. Because they have such an influence on our life, and we're talking about breaking something that has evolved over eons of centuries, and it's how we survived and came to be where we are today, in part. Yeah. Yes. I'm sure there's other factors.
yes.
It sounds almost cliche to be like, and we talk about this a lot, the sacred pause, pausing to make space between stimulus and response. But what strategies do you recommend for breaking that negative bias and those habits and fostering more positive ones?
Mm-hmm. So we are actually very good at self-correcting as humans. So I love that, the space between the pause so that you can change your reaction into a response. And at first it might feel automatic, and it probably is because it's deeply ingrained in what you've always done. You don't think about how you put on the light when you walk in, you just do it. You don't think about how you make your coffee in the morning or brush your teeth, you just do it without thought. And that's sometimes how our behaviors are as well. We react in certain situations without thought, but we're quite good at correcting. So if you bring attention to that thing that you want to change, and you're saying, okay, the next time I'm in that situation, I want to respond versus react, even if you don't get it right the first, second, third, or fourth, fifth time, you will eventually start making that space a little bit bigger. Now there's a couple of things that you could do. So one is practicing. So by mentally rehearsing, or if anybody suffers with aphantasia, which is the inability to visualize, you could write it down as an activity where you maybe write down or visualize, these are the scenarios where I tend to react, and this is how I would like to respond instead. And with enough practice, you will be able to change that. The other thing is that we use triggers and cues. A cue is a trigger that triggers a habitual response, and we need that cue. So sometimes that cue will trigger us to respond in a particular way, but we can actually then add something positive to that end of that sequence. So let's say I used to get very angry if you were parking incorrectly in the neighborhood that I used to live in in England, because it was very limited parking, and people would just kind of park halfway in a parking spot anyway. And I remember thinking, okay, so if you get triggered and you react, then what you could do at the end of that is put something positive. So something like a physiological sigh, which is a breathing technique that helps you regulate your stress response back to a calm state. So eventually what you're doing is you're using that negative and turning it into a positive. So you're bypassing that negative reaction and saying, okay, well, actually this trigger or this cue normally triggers a habitual response that is now positive, because I know that the physiological side comes at the end of this whole sequence of events, just getting angry and then regulating from it.
I love that. So what if the remembrance of doing the sigh happens not until a couple hours later, maybe even that evening, like say this happened in the morning, the parking, and you were like, wow, I'm still kind of holding my breath. Is there like a recommended time frame in which to, I'm assuming the sooner the better.
Yes. But the sooner the better. But you know, if you're thinking about it in the day, then you're already ingraining that in your neuronal network, in your capacity for what you think about during the day. It's better than not thinking about it at all. So practice it. And then, as I said, like, we do have a really good way of self-correcting. We need to give our brains a little bit more credit, because they're actually more capable of making positive habitual changes. And I think we sometimes give them credit for talking about brains as if they're like the third person that doesn't exist within us. But
that's so interesting. And I love it when you were speaking about that, the practice and the mental rehearsal, writing it down. It's like this idea for me of planting a seed and then kind of watering it and nourishing it and coaxing it. And at first it's kind of fragile. And you have to pay a little bit more attention. And then I guess the idea is that it becomes more of an automatic response to pause and think about a reaction, or to create that sigh immediately post reaction. And that space in between becomes more and more, you know, habitual.
Yeah. And bigger. It's almost like you can watch that space grow in a way. And I think that there's solace in that, because it can change. And by practicing it, you're essentially telling your brain, you're giving it an alternate solution. Because if you've always practiced, or if you've always behaved in a particular way, and you've not given the brain an opportunity to see an alternative, when you're in that situation where you're on the spot, you're probably going to revert to automatic processing and do what you've always done. But if you know that you've been mentally rehearsing or practicing this alternate solution, you'll actually end up finding yourself at a crossroads where you go, okay, this is the route I've normally taken. This is where I want to go this time. And eventually you'll start to be able to make that choice more habitually and automatically.
I love this. I want to practice. There, you mentioned something about visualization. I can't remember the word you used, but it sounded like a clinical condition where that wasn't something that somebody could access. Could you tell me more about that?
Yes. So aphantasia is, I guess it's a clinical diagnosis. It's the inability to form mental imagery in your mind. So if you ask someone with aphantasia to imagine a red apple in their mind, they wouldn't be able to do that. They have more abstract ways of thinking. I'm not entirely sure, because I can very much visualize, but I do have friends who've got it. It's sort of classified as a neurodivergency, but it's there are other ways that, you know, the people with aphantasia can imagine.
Yeah. Okay, cool. And one of them would be like physically writing it down, maybe drawing something. I mean,
yes. Yeah, exactly. Because that's still visualization in itself. I think we've just assumed that visualization is only in your mind. But if you have a vision board, or you're visualizing how your day is going to go by time blocking it on a diary, that is still a form of visualizing.
Oh, vision boards. Gosh, it's been a while since I've done one, but I used to create collages all the time, especially as a kid. I was always creating collages, and even as a youngster, it felt like there was such magic and power in that. Could you speak to the power of visualization in your thoughts a little more?
Absolutely. So what I love about vision boarding, I don't personally do it, because I have, as I said, I can visualize quite well, so I don't need to actually sort of collage, but it really does help some people. But we essentially start paying more attention to the things that are within our conscious mind. So you have mental imagery and things in your periphery all of the time, sounds, background noises, background images, not so much in my case because I'm sitting with a blank wall behind me, but I can see that there's a window on my right-hand side and, you know, I can see that there's a light here on the left. You can't see it, but I can. But my brain is saying that you're important right now. But those images are still there and the eyes are still filtering that information out. It only pays attention to what you tell it is important. So if I said to you, Tessa, go and have a look at all the red things in your environment right now, you'll start counting them. And then if I say to you, how many blue things were in your environment, you're going to say, I don't know, because I was only paying attention to the red things. But the blue things are still there. And maybe it's the blue things that are the things that are going to get you to your next step, but you've not been paying attention to them. Does that make sense? And it kind of ties in with that negativity bias, because if you go through your day saying, I'm having a bad day, this went wrong, this went wrong, this went wrong, all those wonderful things that did happen, you're just going to bypass them and you're not going to see them. Your brain's going to be blocking them out because it's paying attention to the negativity. So that's why vision boards can really help you to sort of see where you want to be and what it is that you want to invite into your life. So when you see it in your environment, it can reaffirm, yes, 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 and get you closer to that goal of whatever it is that you want to do or be.
I love that. I think closely related, and correct me if I'm wrong, I feel like growth mindset is related to this in some way. So I wanted to start by maybe defining for us what growth mindset is. I think a lot of us might go, well, duh, it's that seems kind of straightforward and obvious, but I think it's important to define terms like this and also mental resilience and how those two relate.
Absolutely. So growth mindset, I'll explain what the opposite is, and that is fixed mindset. And what tends to happen is with individuals with a fixed mindset, they'll attach their identity to the outcome of a problem. So if you fail an exam or you don't get the promotion, that someone with a fixed mindset will directly attribute it to their self-worth or who they are as a person. Whereas an individual with a growth mindset will be able to see that maybe they need to work harder or maybe there's other things at play, like perhaps they were not feeling that well and it's not a direct indicator of their personality. And with the growth mindset, it's actually really interesting because it correlates to an area of the brain called the dorsal anterior cingulate cortex. And what they've seen is that individuals that go through mindset training to become more resilient and have a better growth mindset, that area of the brain becomes more active over time. So we know that it is plastic and we know that it can be improved. And Carol Dweck is one of the leading researchers in this area, and she did research on children. And they told one group of children that they were very smart and they were super intelligent. And then they told the other group, oh, you must have worked really hard at this. I can see the effort you put in. And when they asked the groups of children what the grades they got in the end, the ones that were told they were super smart actually lied about their grades, even though they'd gone in the 90s, but they wanted to prove that they were better. And then when they had to, exactly, and when they had to pick these problem solving or problems to solve from a list, they were avoiding all the difficult ones because they didn't want to accidentally get it wrong and then prove that they weren't actually smart. So there was a direct fear that it would impact them as a person. And that's what's really mind blowing about growth mindset and fixed mindset.
How do we get over that fear of failure? I mean, is it just practicing failing?
Oh my God, Tessa, that's such a great question. I was just thinking that too. I'm like, this is, I think for me, one of the most fascinating things that we do, right? It's like, how do we get past that obstacle? You know, how do we get out of our own way, I guess, is the bigger question.
Yeah. Well, so I've written about it in the book, obviously. And the thing is, the fear never really leaves us. I think we just get better at dealing with it. And I think that kind of helps a little bit because when you talk to professional athletes, you know, Henry Fonda was still being sick before every performance, Jane Fonda's father, in his 70s, which shows that he was still fearful of going on stage. He just, you know, did it anyway. And, you know, there's a wonderful book that was released with that exact name, and it was perfect, Field of Fear, and do it anyway, because fear is what fuels us. We have to have fear, otherwise we wouldn't really care, or there would be no stakes, you know. And the way that we can do it is, the way I've written it in the book is, there's two ways. So you can jump in the deep end, you know, shave your head, start a PhD in the 60s, in your 60s, or go traveling for a year and sell everything. That's one way to do it. That's like really diving in. Or you can do it little by little. And I've called it little by little does the trick. So Max, my puppy, my Malinois, she's reactive, very fearful of the outside. Not so much anymore. She's a bit older now. But it was a lot of training to teach her that the world is a safe place. So it was taking her outside and letting her see a dog from a distance, and they're not trying to kill her. And then, you know, keeping that below threshold. And then over time, she started to learn that actually humans are not bad. Dogs aren't out to get her, and we can now navigate a whole walk, and she's absolutely fine. And that's similar to how we are as humans. We need to see, we need evidence that whatever we're going through isn't actually damaging for us. And then we need to conquer it and see the evidence that we can conquer it. And that's how we slowly, slowly gain more confidence. And the thing is, we gain confidence in places where we don't have any. You know, the first time you do a public speaking event, you've never done it before, so you have to just do it. And then over time, it just becomes part of, you know, what you do.
I love that so much. And I know, even for as long as I've done this, you know, podcasting is more of a familiar place. And obviously, as we get more familiar with doing something, it's more comfortable and you feel more confident as you continue to increase that level of discomfort, right? Because it can be uncomfortable to do something Super. That you're not used to doing.
Yeah.
Right. I have a question about, you know, like the way that we're, I'm not a parent, but like the way that a lot of friends of mine are raising their kids, it's very much focused on avoiding that fear and avoiding that conflict. So when I see, you know, some of my friends hold their child back from experiencing that discomfort. Mm-hmm. All I think is, what's this child going to be like when they're an adult? Are they going to be fearful of taking chances? Are they going to want to just stay within the confines of whatever their life is? So I'm curious what your take is on what's happening with that.
Absolutely. And one of the things I wrote about in the book is the continuum theory, where there's a Venezuelan tribe, it's called the Yaquena tribe. And for the first 18 months, they don't put down their baby. So the baby learns through body language what is right and what is wrong. So when the mother leans over into the pot, she pulls the baby away, and the baby learns that that's hot and shouldn't go near it.
I love what you're saying. So this Venezuelan tribe holds on to their children until 18 months.
Yes, and they don't put
for 18 months.
And yeah, that's including sleeping.
Apparently, if they need to go to the bathroom, they will get up, pick up the child, take it with them. Uh-huh. Now, we learn through observational knowledge what our parents do. And for example, again, I was talking to you about Max, who's reactive. When I see a dog, I don't pull her away, and I'm like, oh my God, and I'm like, okay, let's say a prayer and we're going in. Because if I pull her away, she's going to learn that dogs should be feared. And if someone comes near her, or if dogs, and this is like, you know, maybe a reactive dog owner will not like what I'm about to say, but when dogs off lead come and run up to us, I don't get angry. I'm like, hey, it's like, oh, your dog's really sweet. Can you please take her? And I'll actually take the dog and escort it back instead of going, oh my God, take your dog back and get angry. And I know it's really frustrating. I know I like, off-leash people that don't know, have control of their dogs are the most annoying. But what my point that I'm trying to prove is that if Max sees me yelling at somebody about their dog, she doesn't like people and she doesn't like dogs. I'm teaching her that they're not good people, you know, that these people are not good. And so it is with children. So we absorb everything through our childhood, how the world works, the rules of how, where we fit in it, and the observational knowledge from our parents. So we can learn how to get to school by just watching our parents taking us. And you don't really have to teach a child that, you just end up knowing it after a few years, but you also pick up on those behaviors of shielding them from the outcome, talking badly about other people, talking badly about yourself. So it's really important to sort of really assess. I'm not a parent, but I have a niece. My sister and I have these conversations all the time about what she's absorbing through just watching.
Yeah, I agree. I have don't have children, but I have a couple of nieces and nephews, and it's just so interesting for me to just see that. And it's interesting too about the dog situation, because one of my pit bulls, he's very anxious, especially around my niece. She's been around since she was little, but when she was three or around three or four, we were playing by the pool, and you know how kids get very hyperactive and, you know, they start screaming, and I noticed that his whole body would start to shake, and he would try and like grab at her, you know, not bite her, but like trying to like grab at her. She would get outside of the pool and then she would jump in, like get out, you know, with her floaties and jump in. And I noticed that made him really, really anxious. And so she was afraid of him for many years. Like she would come in and she'd be like, no, pick me up. I'm scared. Like they kind of had this thing until my mother-in-law house sat a couple years ago, and she didn't know that we would keep them away from each other. And I remember calling and being like, oh, hey, when my niece gets there, make sure you pick her up, because she's kind of afraid of him and he gets very anxious. And she was like, oh no, they're totally fine. She's already here. Yeah. And I'm like, what? And I'm like, wait, what? Yeah. And then ever since that, she's been totally like we've sort of relaxed. And it's so interesting when we're relaxed, our niece is relaxed and the dog's relaxed, and it just creates a whole nother energetic field.
Because they'll pick up on that. And it's that, again, that observational knowledge. If you're stressed, they're like, I'm stressed. And then it's the whole thing. And that ties back into what you said about, you know, parents shielding their children from the outcome. But the thing is, there's going to be failure always. We are always going to fail at something. I can guarantee you now, you're never going to get it right every single time. So it's more, you know, learning how to deal with that failure at a young age is probably the best thing you can do as a parent to a child.
How do you have that conversation I'm not a parent either, but I often think about how I talk to my nephew, my nieces about how they're experiencing failure. And it seems like what I noticed, and I'm so glad you asked this question, Rosie, because I was literally having this conversation with Jorge yesterday about, you know, I think this generation, what do they call them? Glass children? Have you heard that?
No,
it sounds rather negative, but... the idea that there isn't a lot of resiliency there, and they're very fragile. From that perspective, it's like I'll see my nephew, for example, try something and not get it right away, and then he just won't try it again because he'll be so
demoralized.
Demoralized. So even if it's not a child, but you know, as adults, even I think it's an important conversation to have. How do you have that conversation with yourself about? You know, I love what you said about failure is just not going to go away. It's something we have to learn how to live with. And doing the thing, even though we're scared of it, I think is such an important takeaway. But yeah, what else would you say about having that conversation?
Well, that's how we gain resilience. And that's how we become more adaptable. So if you never, ever, ever experience stress, and then let's say in an experiment, we could remove stress altogether. And then I put you in an environment where your hair elastic snapped and that raises your stress hormones. You're going to be really stressed by that. You're not going to be able to cope. You're probably going to have a breakdown. You know what I mean? So, but if you experience a little bit of stress and then you adapt, and then you have a little bit of stress and you adapt, then, you know, the everyday mundane things like your dog barking and hitting the guitar and, you know, everything going wrong is not going to stress you out. You're going to find it quite funny. But if you're not used to that, you know, that the point I'm trying to make is that we need to be able to feel stress and fear, adapt from it, and then overcome. And then we actually increase parts of our brain, like the dorsal anterior cingulate cortex, which are responsible for resilience, which means that we are better at overcoming failure, but we get better at knowing how to deal with it. I don't know if you can have that conversation with parents. I would imagine that any parent is like, I don't really want to hear what other people have to say, but we just maybe play this podcast out loud on a megaphone in public and Times Square, and hopefully people are listening.
I think that it's such an important conversation, but I also just love to learn about the science of how rewiring your brain actually works. And I think for me, I understand it more in the terms of mindfulness and habit building, and how that starts to create you know, these new neurological pathways in your mind so that you can, you know, continue to, you know, create rituals that are helpful for you.
Yeah.
What's that Jim Rohn quote that says, discipline weighs ounces, regret weighs tons.
Right. Yes.
And so I'm curious for you, like a lot of people that listen to this podcast, you know, are either, you know, into wellness or mm-hmm. they're learning about wellness. Maybe they're into meditation. Maybe they just started learning about meditation. What role do you think mindfulness plays into the rewiring of your brain from a neuroscientist perspective?
Absolutely. I just want to backtrack a little bit because I thought of something that I normally, the way that I explain resilience and failure and all of that is, so just to backtrack a little bit, is if your brain is a database of information and you are a piece of machinery that's upgrading software all the time and you experience failure, your brain is going to be able to have that piece of information so that in future knows what to do or not, what not to do to get to that outcome again. So it's just like data entry point, really, if you think about it. So you're just programming this piece of machinery with more data and saying, okay, well, that failed. Let's not do that again. But you're upgrading the software every time because the brain doesn't really know the difference between right and wrong. It's just data entry. It's just input of information. And the more information that you have, the more things you experience, the more experience you have, right? And I love that actually. So, but back to your question about mindfulness, you know, the fundamental aspect to changing or to making a plastic change is attention. And attention is mindfulness. Mindfulness is being mindful of everything you do, taking a pause. You know, one of my biggest things that I'm trying to do is to stop eating on the go or stop eating whilst I'm like kind of doing something else and just sit there. And my partner will like sit down and he'll thank his food. I mean, he's not religious, but he believes in Mother Nature. So he thanks his food every time. And I'm like, that's such a wonderful thing to do, to actually pay attention. That, you know, an animal had to die for this, or, you know, so a farmer had to plant these plants and raise them for you. I don't know if you raise plants, but grow plants. You know, so it's, and that forms part of this whole, like being attentive in everything you do. And when you're paying attention, that's where you make plastic changes. Because fundamentally, you need acetylcholine and norepinephrine responsible for plastic change. What that means is that if you experience a wonderful experience, like you're at a concert, your favorite song comes on, and I don't know, your partner asks you to marry him, you're going to remember that forever and never, amen, right? You're never going to forget that. Unless it goes Pete Tong, but I think you probably would remember that anyway. Hopefully it doesn't. But that's because emotions are really high, both norepinephrine and acetylcholine. And it tells you that that moment in your life is very important. And that's what attention is. So if you're saying, okay, this is important. Yeah. If you're saying this is important, we need to pay attention. Plastic change. This is important. So if you put on a French tape in the background, you're not going to be able to learn the words as an adult. You have to say, hey, brain, these words are important. Let's listen to them and learn them.
And how do you do that? Like, is there a sort of hack to do that where you're saying, hey, brain, you know, because even that could be a lot of work for somebody to bring their attention back, right? To bring your attention back to this moment. Okay, I have the French tape on, you know, to start to learn, but I'm constantly, the computer of the mind is going to be completely distracted, right? So what is something that we can do in that moment to bring our attention back to the present?
So do you mean like in mindfulness or like as in the French tape experiment?
As in the French tape experiment.
Yeah. So time blocker, you know, you put it into your diary because we run mostly on heuristics. So those are mental shortcuts. So if you're used to doing particular things, your brain's probably not going to remind you to make new changes. It wants to save energy for more cognitively demanding tasks. So heuristics are shortcuts to what your brain will do so that it doesn't have to think about those things. So you have to kind of remind yourself every day of what it is that you want to do, like learn French. So time blocking it can really help so that you have that in your diary. And the other thing is the brain operates on repetition. So a lot of people will think, oh, well, I don't have an hour a day to commit to French, so actually it's useless. I'm not going to even do it. But even just 5 minutes every day is better than nothing. And one thing that really stuck with me is someone made a post, and I can't remember who it was. They said something like, if you scroll for an hour a day instead of working on your goals, how good are you going to be at scrolling in 5 years' time? How good are you going to be at picking up your phone and scrolling through social media and getting lost in that loop versus yes. playing the guitar or speaking French?
What a powerful visualization.
I know. I'm really good at scrolling. I'll tell you what.
We all are. I'm like compulsive notification checker.
Yes. Oh, I'm with you, Nicole, on that one.
Yeah.
I was curious to add on to that. As I sit here sipping my matcha, if you've done any research about the effect as well on focus, and you mentioned time blocking in terms of, let's say, the time of day where your attention might be more focused, or the effects of focusing in conjunction with something like caffeine, or even in conjunction with something like alcohol or any other substance.
Caffeine and L-theanine actually have very good research around them, because caffeine gives you that boost and L-theanine takes that anxiety edge off. So they normally are really good kind of like quote unquote nootropic to help you get into like a flow state. But in terms of times of day, generally speaking, I know that there are, you know, chronotypes, you know, night owls, morning people, but the first 8 hours of your day, regardless of when you wake up, I wake up at 7. I used to wake up at 6, but now that I'm taking a break from the book, so I'm like just waking up at 7. But it's 6 o'clock makes it easier for me. If I get up at 6, from 6 till 2, you have the highest levels of norepinephrine and dopamine to your sleep schedule. So if you wake up at 10 a.m., it'll be from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m., 6 p.m., because my math is really bad. Now you're putting me on the spot. My math is shocking. I redid my maths when I was 25 to get into university because I basically flunked high school and I still got a B. I was like, I really tried. But anyway.
You know what? Don't feel bad, because that's been my biggest vice too. And I just went back to college. I went back to university. I went back to uni.
Yeah.
I went back to uni. And I for some reason I had to take a math class, and I'll tell you, it was one of my biggest struggles, I have to say.
Yeah. It gives me anxiety. So the first 8 hours of your day, for me it's 6 till 2 PM, that's when you have high levels of norepinephrine, high levels of dopamine. So you're more likely to engage in activities that are harder to adopt. So if you want to adopt a running habit, you're more likely to adopt it in the first 8 hours of your day. So it doesn't have to be a morning thing. It could be at 12 o'clock or 1 o'clock. Thereafter, you're more serotonergic, because serotonin is the precursor to melatonin, and melatonin puts you to sleep. So serotonergic evenings is why you can feel more emotional at night. You can feel like maybe doing something slower and softer is better. Now, I said something like meditation, and the internet ate me alive, because they're like, meditation is not easy. And I was like, no. But compared to running, if you're not a runner, it is more physically demanding, as in taking a lot more energy from your system than meditation. So you can sort of find the habits that you want to adopt and slot them in according to your circadian rhythm. And then the last 8 hours, so the third phase of the night, is sleep. And that is where you consolidate all of your memories. Fundamentally, the most important part of habit adoption, because if you don't consolidate the new information you just acquired, the information is fragmented in your brain. You then make it solid when you sleep. And if you don't sleep well, you're essentially like, it's like bits of information get lost.
Mm. So interesting. I love this. Nicole, I'm sure I'm speaking for both Rosie and I when I say we could sit here and chat with you all day. You have so much information to share, and I'm just so grateful that your work is out into the world. And congrats on your book.
Thank you.
I said it in the intro, but I'm going to say it again, Rewire Your Neuro Toolkit for Everyday Life. I'm imagining it. You can pick it up wherever books are sold.
Everywhere and anywhere. Yeah.
Awesome. Yeah. And where is best to go? You know, where do you like to connect with people? How can people find your work?
On Instagram. That's the only account that I'm really active on.
Awesome. Thank you. Make sure that you, is it Nicole Vignola?
It's Nicole. Yes, Nicole Vignola. You'll find that it's actually Nicole's Neuroscience, but if you type my name, it will come up. So,
okay.
Yes.
We'll make sure that gets into the show notes. And I just want to ask one final question. We typically ask, you know, at the end of the Radically Love podcast, what is it that you radically love? How do you feel radically loved? But we've been kind of changing it, changing direction a little bit. And I'm going to piggyback on that direction change that Rosie's been adding. And that is to think back on, or to look at yourself from that 15-year-old lens and think about, you know, as a 15-year-old, knowing what you know now about neuroscience and all of this amazing body of work, what advice would you give yourself to that 15-year-old self?
Wow. 15-year-old self was in a dark place. My father died, unfortunately, when I was young. Oh, but no, so that's sorry. Fine. It's a good question. It's a very good question. I think to stop caring so much about what people think. You know, when you're that age, you just put way too much emphasis on other people and you build your self-worth on what you're getting from them. But they don't know themselves either. So we're all just, you know, little kind of people bobbing in the world and all just trying to validate each other and ourselves through each other. But I think, you know, finding a way to radically love yourself and the things that are important, knowledge and information. That was the question, right? 15-year-old me. 15-year-old.
Yes.
Me. Yes.
I know.
Yes.
I kind of weaved two questions and then just asked you one. But
no,
I mean, the namesake of the podcast is Radically Loved, and that's why we would typically ask, "How do you feel radically loved?" and "What do you radically love?" But I also love, you know, the looking back on your 15-year-old self and like for you being in such a challenging time in your life. I think it's so interesting to think about. I still struggle with that answer that you gave yourself, don't care about what people think so much. I mean, I still struggle with that today.
Yes. And I think it's something that maybe we'll fundamentally always struggle with. You know, like I've been having a bit of a change on my Instagram where I'm shifting to video content. And I think my followers are not really used to that. So the engagement is very low. And I keep having to have these conversations with myself, like, your worth is not dictated by the numbers. Your worth is not dictated by what people are saying, doing, liking. And I think that it's probably the hardest thing to kind of hack. But when you do, I think you live a way more peaceful life. Because my biggest fundamental sort of belief, I think, around longevity, around well-being, you know, you've got all these hacks as to what you need to do to live longer. But for me, it's, are you aligned with yourself? Can you sit alone in a room and not argue with yourself, not second guess yourself, trust yourself in situations? And I think that that's, for me, is probably the biggest driver to your mental health, which then drives your physical health.
Mm. So good. Nicole, thank you. Gosh, I really appreciate your wisdom.
Thank you so much.
Hey, friends. Thank you so much for listening to the Radically Love podcast. Don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review wherever you get your podcasts. It really helps. Also, don't forget to check out the Mindful Love Hub on Substack. This episode was produced by Tessa Tovar, music by DJ Taz Rashid.